results, how I actually get numbers out, and then compute the constraints from LEC running at 7 TeV, and then briefly discuss dark matter detection and flavor physics, and then summarize. So this is a hierarchy of masses for fermions in the standard model, not including neutrinos, of course. So looking at this pattern, one might conjecture that first generation is quite light, second generation is still rather light, and the third generation is actually kind of heavy, modulo strong running, and some intergenerational mixing. So we know from supersymmetry that, well, when we work with supersymmetry at MSSM, we often make the approximation that the Yukawa couplings for the first two generations are zero, and for the third generation are non-zero. And in fact, depending on your value of tan beta, your Yukawas approach each other at high scale in the third generation. So then we can ask the question, is this pattern ad hoc, or can we associate it with some kind of dynamics? So in the standard model, we gauge some group, okay, SU3 by SU2 by U1, and that could be part, before you gauge it, maybe it's part of some other bigger global group. And then we can ask, so how can we get light chiral fields, the first two generations, in the fundamental of this gauge group? Well, we can think of a toy model. So let's just take SU2 by U1. And then out of three generators, two are broken. And then we can reassemble them in this fashion. And so we go from a SU2, which goes which is like a three-sphere, down to a three-sphere by U1, which is a Riemann two-sphere, CP1. And that indeed is mapped by two normalized coordinates. So then if we were to gauge this U1, then we find that these toy pions are in the fundamental complex representation of this group. So for our application, we would need to do this with fermions. And I should add that once, even though you gauge this U1, and that that does not affect the validity of this picture. So of course, there are other problems in the standard model. We have the Higgs hierarchy problem, dark matter, gauge unification, and so on.
Why do you emphasize on the gauging of the U1? And don't you get non-global symbols in the non-global symmetry?
Sure. So it's just a very simple example of how you can get Nabu-Goldson bosons in the fundamental representation of this symmetry that you're gauging. Because that's what we have to do here, right? We want to get out fundamentals of SU3 by SU2 by U1. And we want those to be Nabu-Goldson bosons, or fermions. Of course, in supersymmetry is often invoked to address these problems. Of course, it presents its own problem. One is the mu problem, and another is the flavor / CP problem. You use gauge mediation that is solved readily, but if you use gravity mediation, then you have to worry about your breaking sector and what that looks like. One way to help with flavor constraints is to have a horizontal symmetry where the first and second generation squarks are roughly of the same mass, and the third generation squarks are rather heavy. Now, this doesn't mean that these squarks are necessarily light. It's just that these are heavier. And of course, if you have a horizontal symmetry, then that relieves a number of constraints already.
Okay. Sorry. If you just think about the whole point of the symmetry, which is partially on the hierarchy problem, you want it exactly like reverse, right? You want the third generation to be lighter because you want it to
That's true.
Resolve the fine tuning.
That's true. So it depends how much fine tuning you want to accept.
Are you going to discuss it at all, or is it not?
I wasn't going to discuss that. It'll turn out that, first of all, these won't be that different in mass, percentage-wise, because of the LHC constraints. They don't have to be rather heavy anyway. Mm-hmm. And right now, if you have TUV squarks, you're looking at percent fine-tuning or even harsher.
Right. But I guess your setup, there's just no way to alleviate that because you're bounded by this. Because one can imagine alleviating some of it by making the stops lighter.
That's true. And in fact, it's also true that you can have light stops and still relatively light stops and evade current constraints, right?
Right, but yeah. That's what I'm saying.
But yeah, but that's not compatible with my setup. That's true. Okay, so let's set up a coset space. So my model setup is, of course, MSUSE is going to be TUV scale, and then I'm going to have some confinement scale, which is above the SUSE breaking scale, which I'm going to take to be M Planck, and from gravity mediation. And then I'm going to also assume that M gut is close to M Planck and not two orders of magnitude lower. And you'll see a phenomenological reason why. And also, it makes the model building much simpler. You don't have to worry about the threshold corrections from breaking SUSE and then breaking your gut down to standard model groups. This is an aesthetic choice. You could try to have the gut at 10 to the 16 GV and the SUSE breaking at Planck scale, but for simplicity, I chose M gut to be M Planck. And there's a phenomenological reason, which I'll get to soon. So, okay, we want the first and second generation standard model fermions to be the SUSE partners of Nambu-Goldstone bosons. And then we leave the third generation as a matter field, because that's heavy. So we need a supersymmetric nonlinear sigma model to implement this. Okay, so how do we build one? Well, I don't know how familiar you are with the Lagrangians and Wessenbagger, but this is the bosonic kinetic term. And if you have a global symmetry breaking, then what happens is the metric for the unbroken generators are in the isometry are trivial, but the metric element for broken generators can be rather complicated. And for E7, which is a rather large symmetry, it's actually quite nasty. Of course, the canonical example, like of an S3 nonlinear sigma model, you can it's easy to write down what the metric is, but in this case, it's not.
Well, I mean, some of it has to do with field redefinition. So even if you have a nasty metric, it is possible that there is some field redefinitions that make this trivial. So in the case we mentioned S2, you can write it as, you know, the kinetic term divided by 1 over pi squared, then you expand it, and you get all the other terms. In that case, G is sort of complicated, but there is a field redefinition that makes this rather simpler.
So I don't know if there's a good field redefinition for the E7 by SO10 Kähler manifold. There are references for writing down nonlinear realizations, but I don't know. I've never seen anything for transforming it to a standard realization.
No, all of it will still be a nonlinear transformation.
Sure.
But I'm just saying, like, the Lagrangian you end up writing for pi doesn't involve some funny kinetic GIJ.
So your statement is you can always bring into a canonical kinetic term.
Right. And you just get all the nastiness appears in the interaction terms.
Right, you can write it as u, which is e to the, it's an exponent of the metric,
right.
The I prime.
Right. Right.
Then you write the kinetic term is just simply just dmu u.
Right.
And then all the nonlinear stuff just appears when you expand the exponent to higher orders. And
okay.
You find all the 4-point interactions and all that.
So it appears all in the Kähler potential books. Because this
right.
is
the
metric of the Kähler potential.
That's right. Yeah. And then here's the corresponding four fermion type term. And this, in rigid supersymmetry, this is just the curvature of the Kähler manifold. Once you couple it to gravity, then it becomes a bit more complicated. With this, but it reflects the isometries of the Kähler manifold.
These nonlinear signal models lead to two things. They're not renormalizable.
That's right.
And you get strong coupling. In the electroweak sector, you get strong coupling.
In the electroweak sector?
Well, I mean, people use the nonlinear signal model to hide the Higgs.
That's right.
And then you get into strong coupling. It's not renormalizable.
I agree. So mine.
No, that's not necessarily true. It doesn't have to go to strong coupling. It's a question of when the Higgs appears or not. Whether there's strong coupling is a question of where did you initialize the theory.
Do you want to fit the data?
Well, I don't think he has data for SL7. So he doesn't have to worry about the problems that we want.
He's thinking about a nonlinear segment model up at the
Planck scale
or nearby.
Oh,
and E7 to SL7.
Right. And so all these guys are roughly the same scale, and this is the confinement scale where things get strong, and this is at or above the Planck scale.
So what about me today?
Right. So this is a theoretical framework for producing a certain effect at low energy, and that's what I'm going to be discussing. One effect is that the Yukawa couplings for the first two generations is small, and the other, and then there are other effects that we could possibly measure in the next few years. Okay, so, and then to preserve supersymmetry, at least until we break it, you need to match up your numbers of degrees of freedom, and so twice the fermion degrees should be equal to the total of the bosonic degrees. And these are from the Nabu-Goldstein bosons, and these are from any extra scalars you might build into your theory. Now, it turns out this has to be at least one, okay? And the reason is that it's not just you're breaking the symmetry of G, but you're also breaking its complex extension. So you're going to have at least one of these guys. But you can prove that that the number of these is minimal if the coset space is Kähler. Okay, so.
Could you remind us what is the definition of a coset which is Kähler?
Of a what?
Of a Kähler coset space. How do you define a Kähler coset? What is the definition of
that? Oh, my understanding is that it just meets the Kähler conditions.
Which are, do you remember that?
These guys?
I see, yeah.
Yeah. So perhaps it's a little confusing. I have the Kähler manifold in my supersymmetric theory.
Right.
And then I also require that
here you're talking about the Kähler manifold in the IJ indices, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I also have a Kähler manifold that's the coset space.
Right.
Okay. And it's important that's Kähler, otherwise your theory gets ugly. Okay. All right, so here's my SUSY Kähler potential, and then your scalar kinetic term comes out of that, and these are the Kähler conditions. And of course, your supersymmetric Lagrangian is supposed to be invariant under the Kähler transformation. However, in supergravity, you're not completely free as to what this function is. As long as W is finite, and if you have a non-zero cosmological constant, it's finite, then you can't simply invoke this transformation to make the this Lagrangian invariant, because you have this sigma cubed term. So how do you get around this? There's two major requirements. So the coset space must not only be Kähler, but also non-compact. And there's an elegant proof by Bagger and Witten as to why that's the case. And then more recently, Yanagida and a mathematician figured out that you can't have any U1 factors in your preserved group. And this is actually really deep. It has to do, it's actually the same problem as the Fayette Eliopoulos U1 under and supergravity. You can actually, if you have U1 factors in H, you can actually recast using spurions into something that looks like a Fayette Eliopoulos shift in your Lagrangian. And and of course, the reason this is a problem is that if you you can do this kind of transformation in your Lagrangian, and then you write down your superspace integral, and if it's not traceless, then you have a change. Then your Lagrangian is not invariant. So as long as H is traceless, then you're okay.
But does this only hold when your manifold is Kähler, or it holds in general?
I think it holds in general. Because this has to do with H, not with the coset space.
Right, but it shows a very particular type of coset space.
That's true. But I think this is a more general result.
How do you say that this has nothing to do with H? That this has only to do with H? Because you started the whole thing, you said if I chose a Kähler coset, I have a minimal number of tuples
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. I mean, if you don't assume an inequality, it may have maybe a different kind of manifold.
That's true.
And then is it still true that you will not have a U1 factor? So Kubu Yanagida theorem does not hold for without metrics.
So if you have a non-Kähler coset space, then you don't have to worry about the U1s. I don't know for sure the answer to your question, but my thinking is it doesn't matter, but maybe we should discuss that more. I'm not sure.
Sorry, so if one tries to write down a Kähler potential for a G-mod H that doesn't satisfy this, is that just a theory that breaks supersymmetry up the high scale, or is that non-existent? What are you saying about spaces that don't satisfy those criteria?
This one will break supersymmetry when you couple to supergravity.
Okay.
And I also believe this one will also break supersymmetry when you couple to supergravity.
Okay.
It just means you have a anomaly, so you cannot change.
Yeah, once you also have gravity.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Your supersymmetry has an anomaly, so you can...
Yeah, change. Yeah. Okay. So, the general form of the... This is the general form of the Kähler potential, and V is the scale of breaking, so of the big group, and... when you break the U1s, then you have some freedom as to this function. Usually papers just say that it's the logarithm. And the point is that G is nonlinearly realized by these fields. Okay. And so if you want to see an example.
Sorry, how does your sign relate to your phis? You're talking about phi fields and psi fields.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relation between those things?
The phis, the broken phis, are in these psi in some complicated way.
Psi isn't done. Okay.
Yeah. And if you want a simple example where you can actually build your psi, then in my last paper, you can look.
You should have the archive number.
Oh, yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah. So in this paper, we have a very simple case of a U6 by U6 by U4 times U2 model, and that you can actually write a matrix. You can write down the matrix representation for psi. For something as big as E7, you can look it up, but there's no easy way to write it down as a matrix. Okay, so this is standard supergravity Lagrangian. We just couple our Kähler potential inside here. And we don't specify the exact mechanism of breaking other than to assume that it's gravity mediated, and we just assert some singlets in the Kähler potential that'll get a VEV. Now, this is an important point. The Nambu-Goldstone bosons will remain massless at high scale until you break supersymmetry. But these quasi-Nambu-Goldstone degrees of freedom from the broken U1s. That's the deep connection of these U1s, is that they're associated with these quasi-Nambu-Goldstone degrees of freedom in your theory. So when you break these U1s, then these degrees of freedom get massive. Oh, that's just a name they came up with in the 80s for these things.
A new
field.
So are these just fields that are massless at tree level but get masses at one load?
What you want to do is actually explicitly break the U1s.
Okay.
Otherwise, it'll be a problem. So they get the mass at whatever scale you're breaking them.
Right.
In my case, Planck scale. Okay, so let's try to put together an E7 by SO10 model. Okay, so first of all, why might we care about E7 other than this application? Well, it does appear in n equals 8 supergravity, and a nonlinear realization of E7 gives what a so-called simplest field theory. I only understood the first few pages of the paper, so I can't say anything anything deeper about that statement.
But, why is it the simplest field theory?
If I recall the most complicated type of diagram you can have in this field theory is a box diagram.
It is?
That's what I remember from this paper, yeah.
In a different expansion. Another way of saying it is that if you look at S matrix elements in that theory, they all vanish in a certain infinite complex momentum direction. They vanish faster than in any other field, than is generic in any other field theory. So if that's what you mean by simplest, then it's the simplest.
Okay.
Many people would have other definitions of simplicity.
I have lots.
Simplest with respect to the
analytic
structure of the
analytic system. It means that this has no Landau poles and stuff like that. Because it means that the coupling constants vanish. You've got asymptotically free fields. So that is the simplest field theory, in a sense.
Well, that's not clear, actually. Well, the generalization of. No, I mean, the finiteness or the asymptotic anything in n equals 8 is not. But anyway,
okay.
I suspect that your motivations are different.
Right. I just this is just something I threw in here, but Okay, so in order to incorporate our standard model fields, it's convenient to think in gut-like representations. So of course, SU5 gives you 2 Higgs's, a 10 and a 5 star, and then SO10 fundamental and 16 will decompose into Higgs and 10 and 5 star and right-handed neutrino. So what coset works? Well, E7 as the big group works. So the problem with E7 by SU5, of course you want to break these U1s later, is that you get 3 massless generations and one massless Higgs at high scale. E7 by SO10 works much better. You get 2 desired, and then you have to worry about 2 massless Higgses at high scale. And E6 just doesn't give you even a complete generation. E8 gives you mirror families. You get multiple of this set.
I had to ask my question at this point. What killed GUTS? The rescue strongest thing. What dissuaded people from doing GUTS? Is that the proton refuses to decay.
that's the
so if how you if, deal with this?
Right. So if you have a gut theory that doesn't have R parity and is at 10 to the 16 GeV, then it's dead. If you have one that's R parity, then it's marginally excluded at 10 to 16 GeV. If you have a 10 to the, if you have a Planck scale gut and R parity, then I think you're safe from proton decay for until at least you get a hyper K type instrument.
So the problem is that you have to, I won't use the word contrived, but you have to start really working hard not to get the proton to decay.
That's right.
It's not as simple. The simple prediction is that SU5 is not correct.
Yes.
And the simple SO10 is not correct. So then you have to start elaborating as to why things are not working.
So in my case,
that
I think is mostly correct. In my case, my first model I'm going to show is not a gut model. And my second one is a kind of contrived gut model that raises the unification scale to Planck scale and that evades your proton decay constraints.
Well, we're never going to see the proton decay at the Planck scale.
You would need an enormous instrument.
You're
yeah.
safe forever.
There are some wild proposals out there for massive tank detectors that are like sunk in the ocean or in converted oil tankers. I don't know if those will ever get funded because they were from Japan and now they're short of money even more than before.
You need the whole Mediterranean Ocean.
Maybe. I haven't worked out.
If you work it out.
It's a few orders of magnitude. Okay.
Well, it's also a question of which operators are contributing. If it's a dimension 5 operator, we're only 2 orders of magnitude. Dimension 6.
Right, so dimension 5 operators would still be a danger in an SO10 gut. You just wouldn't have the very dangerous dimension 4 mm-hmm. operators. Yeah. So yeah. So order of 100, so that's why these like oil tanker concepts could possibly push the proton lifetime high enough to cause a problem for these guts.
But potentially 19 GeV is going up faster than potentially 16 to 10 to 19. 10 to the 15 is the guts, the old guts.
Okay, it depends on your definition. Yeah.
Anyway,
okay. All right, but the point of this is just that we want standard model representations coming out of our coset space. Okay. Okay, so we can see what might work or what doesn't work. So let's say you have a light 5 star and a light 10 in your third generation, and then you try to scan over the down-type Higgs soft mass and the up-type Higgs soft mass. And what you find is that there's no allowed region. The red gives you the right dark matter density. Away from that, in this direction, you have too much, and over here, you get your lightest supersymmetric particle is charged. And then yellow, you have a problem with Higgs and beta S gamma and direct detection constraints all up in here. So it just doesn't work because you can't have light third generation squarks. Okay, so let's make the third generation heavy. Then you see that there are these two bands that give you the right dark matter density, and otherwise you're more or less clear. Now, what if we want to make the input scale the Planck scale? Then what happens is that you actually get this nice big patch where both the Higgs and uptype and downtype Higgs soft masses can be zero at the input scale. And then you get the right dark matter density rather easily.
What about the Higgs hierarchy?
I'm sorry?
The electric weak theory dies at 600 GeV in the Higgs class.
I'm sorry, what dies at 600 GeV?
If you have a Higgs class bigger than 600 GeV, then the theory breaks down.
So well, it becomes strongly non-perturbative, right?
There's a Planck mass here as well, right?
Yes, this is just the Higgs soft mass at high scale. So, in fact, what happens schematically is that your uptype Higgs soft mass, when it runs down, gets driven big to TeV by the top Yukawa, and your downtype Higgs gets driven lower. And then at the electroweak, well, at SUSY scale, you end up with Higgs soft masses that are roughly the same, the right magnitudes in order to get the right standard model Higgs mass. Or at least a viable standard model Higgs mass. Less than 130 GeV is still pretty safe.
There's a window between 115 and 140.
Right. And all of these models live in that region. So the models I'll show you, they're formally different, but the spectrum is roughly the same, and that's the Higgs is 117 GeV in my model.
So, what if next year this goes away?
Well, then the model's dead.
This is good physics.
I'm making predictions, yeah.
Falsified.
Right. Okay, so let's put the model together. So global symmetry must be gauged anyway, so we can gauge the SU5 inside the SO10. And in fact, for this first model, let's just gauge SU3 by SU2 by U1. Let's forget about gut, okay? And now the U1 squared that was in the factor here, we have to explicitly break those, as discussed. And then you get two novenos that are Planck scale. So you can write down the superpotential. So you have your standard Yukawa couplings. And of course, the point is that these Yukawa couplings for the first and second generation are highly suppressed. Okay. And then your singlets, you have sterile neutrino. And I'm not getting into what to do with the sterile neutrinos, but the first and second generation sterile neutrinos can be light compared to the Planck scale, and the third has to be rather comparable to the Planck scale. And then the novenos are Planck scale, and then you can have a mu term. Now, I'm not solving the mu problem here, but this mu term should be rather much smaller than the Planck scale because you have a forbidden coupling. But how much smaller, you can't say. Is it TeV, or is it 10 to the 10 GeV? It just has to be much smaller than Planck scale. So leaving that alone, is assuming that's TeV scale and getting the right electroweak symmetry breaking. Now, what if you want to make a gut model? Okay, so you gauge SU5 instead of SU3 by SU2 by U1, and then you have your gut Higgs interaction here, and then you're allowed this coupling as well, but this is also highly suppressed because again, these are Nambu Goldstone. Then, for either of these models, what we have outstanding issue, which is we need to set the right boundary conditions so that we get the right dark matter density from our neutralinos that we showed in showed in the scans earlier, and we have to evade the current bounds from the LHC. So as recently as last year, you could. You can get away with a simpler model, but now the Luino soft mass has to be bigger, so I'm going to show you that. But for this gut, to get the right boundary conditions and get the right relic density and get with Nambu Goldstone Higgses, then we need to make M gut equal to M Planck. And so this is the contrived part of the gut model, is that you can gauge the un-Higgs part of this 24, and you know it's natural since it doesn't have an R charge of 2 for a coupling to be much less than 1, and then you can make this and this much less than the gut scale. So if you were to fortuitously choose 10 to the 12 GeV, then you can get the unification instead of being 10 to the 16 GeV to happen at 10 to the 18 GeV.
So I'm going to ask this question. What happens to the crossing of the coupling constants? Because this is the famous reason for doing surface symmetry, is that you get to cross at 10 to the 15 GeV, 10 to 16 GeV, but you're at the gut scale.
At the Planck scale, yeah.
Planck scale, I mean.
So that's why I have this little bit of contrivance in order to make the crossover happen at Planck scale.
Wow. How contrived is this?
It's not that contrived in the sense that we're not introducing any new fields. These are already here. However, we are gauging it, and you have to choose the mass scale for these guys in order to get this crossover. Now, if you were to make a more elaborate theory, you can do something at this scale, maybe related to seesaw or something like that. But I'm not doing that.
The crossing is obtained from the normalization group.
Yes.
Yes. So, how do you get around the 1/1 log behavior copy constant?
It's still 1/log behavior. You just get additional terms because these guys kick in above 10 to the 12 GeV. And the deviation is not that big, actually. Like it hardly affects your MSSM spectrum if you install something like this.
It's just adding more matter. So yeah. If you did it at a different scale, would the shift of the gut scale just move, or do the three not?
They wouldn't even meet.
They don't meet, okay. So
if you do gauge these guys, it has to be this scale.
Right, okay. So if you do gauge them, you get new slopes.
Yes.
And by picking the point at which they
right. Move. You'll notice that the U1 trajectory isn't changed because there's
right.
no, there's we're not gauging that one. It's just the SU3 and SU2.
Right.
So it's not, it's contrived, but it's not completely arbitrary.
How carefully do you have to choose? So those two fields, they don't start deviating at the same point, if I'm reading your label. Right? So it means that you have to choose a little carefully where you put each field in 2012.
You don't have to choose that carefully. It depends how good of an agreement you want here.
Well, that's we know how good an agreement we need to have. Right, we have a good measurement of alpha 3.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not something. How carefully do you actually have to choose the next digit in 2012?
Not that carefully. I can show you, but it's you have a leeway of an half an order of magnitude above, half an order of magnitude below.
So you have your alpha, the fine structure cost, it's going up usually for gauging the
collection.
Yeah, so this is enm coming down. This is 1 over alpha.
Not 1 over, yeah. It's 1 over. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's still kind of, okay, so it's still okay.
Okay, and if we have a gut theory, so you know, again, first model, we don't care about gauge unification, we just gauge standard model directly, and we live with that. Here, if you have a gut theory, we have to A, shift the M gut up to M Planck, and B, deal with the doublet triplet splitting problem. Okay. So this is the simplest missing partner you can write down for where you have the 50 of SU5. So it contains the triplet, but not the doublet. So so you can couple the 50 to the triplet inside the 5 Higgs, and that of course would make the triplet component of the Higgs gut slash Planck scale. However, anytime you invoked a large representation like this, you're risking huge threshold corrections during your breaking. Another method that I think is more elegant is you use product group unification. So you promote your SU5 gut to SU5 gut times SU3 hypercolor times U1 hypercolor. And then you break this big group down to diagonal SU3 color and U1 hypercharge. This is the Lagrangian that breaks it. Here you have the 24 Higgs. And you assign your charges carefully to these fields. And then if this one gets a VEV, and this one gets another VEV, like that looks like this, then you can achieve... So you get VEVs, and then the triplet Higgs gets mass, fine. But a side effect of this is that it also changes your Gugino mass for SU3. Okay, so you get these additional terms for your super symmetry breaking Lagrangian that come from these hypercolor, broken hypercolors. So if you reweight the standard model, well, MSSM Gugino soft masses, then you get an expression like this. These are just color factors. And the upshot is that because this is rather large, you can make the Gugino soft mass significantly bigger than M1/2. Whereas because you have this factor of 15 here, and this is not necessarily big, your Bino soft mass is roughly the same as M1/2, whatever you set. Okay. Again, in the non-gut model, you can set your Gugino masses to whatever you want. Even in Sugra, they're free. Okay, so let's see what is the low energy results of these two model scenarios, which basically give the same MSSM spectrum. Okay, so if I want to compute the MSSM spectrum, then I put in these boundary conditions. So I'm setting my gravitino mass to TeV. This is, of course, flexible. And then, as discussed, the scalar soft mass for first two generations is 0. A0 is also 0 because these dimension 3 couplings are also forbidden. And similarly, the mass terms for up and down Higgs are forbidden. Again, this comes from the picture where you have a non-renormalizable supersymmetric theory, and if you have low-energy theorem applying to the Nambu-Goldstone fields, then you can't even write down the supersymmetry breaking operators that would give them mass. Okay? They still have to have derivatives in them.
If the theory is not renormalizable, how do you know how to extrapolate to the gut scale?
Well, this non-renormal, the scale of the effective theory is Planck scale. So I'm starting there and then going down.
How do you know how the coupling constants behave? Because something like normalizable theory. I should go up in energy.
I'm not going up in energy, I'm only going down in energy.
Well, I mean, but you're at the crossing, the coupling cost, inverse coupling cost is crossing. This means you know the normalization proof theory is renormalizable.
Right, so what I'm doing is I'm writing down the MSSM as an as a renormalizable effective theory of with other operators suppressed by Planck scale. Okay. And I'm starting at Planck scale and going down. I'm not caring about what's at Planck scale or higher.
So your effective theory is at the Planck scale?
Yes.
That's huge.
Yeah.
So the Higgs mass hierarchy problem is awful. If you put in a Planck scale energy cutoff.
No, that's why you have supersymmetry form.
So he's okay, so this is why I was gonna ask, why are you using supersymmetry?
To get fermions, and I still have the other motivation, supersymmetry versus hierarchy problem in dark matter.
But according to the latest, if you believe it, the supersymmetric particle below TeV.
Yes.
And when you recalculate the hierarchy problem for the Higgs, you're already fine-tuning to 100 decimal places.
No, no, one part in a 100, not 100 decimal places.
One?
The fine-tuning is...
So only fine-tuning 1%.
It's 1%.
It's between the supersymmetric mass scale and the Higgs mass.
Yeah.
Higgs scale.
So at the Planck scale, in this case, you have to choose the Higgs to be 101 GeV, for example.
Yeah.
It's funny, I read a paper where that was not the case.
100 decimal places.
It's probably a good thing to discuss in that.
Yeah. Maybe we should let you talk.
Well, yes, a few more slides ago. So, and then, of course, I set M input to M Planck by construction. Okay, so this is where things get a little sketchy. So naively, you're not going to have a B term because that's forbidden. Okay. However, if you actually compute the B term, you know, you have a Cato potential, you have a super potential, and then you write out what things contribute to a B term. If you have a B, you're allowed inside your Cato potential to have a term that's sort of like a B term, right? Where you have some constant or something dependent on your hidden sector times Higgs 1, Higgs 2. Okay. And then whether or not you get a B term depends on the precise form of that interaction inside the Cato potential. And so unless you have a UV completion, you don't know exactly how that term behaves in your Cayley potential. So if you have any more insight on this particular point, please let me know, because this is something I've been thinking about. But phenomenologically, the issue, what this entails is that your tan beta is variable. So your spectrum is more largely unaffected except for small shifts in your stop and bottom. But the more important thing is that your direct detection cross-section varies by an order of magnitude between 10 beta equals 10 and 10 beta equals 50. So what are the implications? Well, okay, first of all, here is a table of masses. So the first two columns are simply for illustration, and the third one is my model. And I rounded the numbers off to not give false precision. But when you have your gluon mass set to 500 instead of 300, okay, then you get two interesting effects. Well, one is that, of course, your gluon gets heavy and your squarks get heavy. And then both these models, of course, the third generation Stau and Sneutrino are going to be heavy because of the soft mass that we set. And okay, but your Higgsinos also get very heavy because they get driven by these heavy third generation fields. And your right-handed slepton is a bit lighter. And that's because of the the weak running from these heavier Higgsinos and neutralinos. Okay, so if you're familiar with the LHC constraints, you can see how this fares. And in my first paper, I demonstrated that you could actually distinguish this 20 GeV difference if you wanted using edge analysis. Okay. So let's look at the constraints from LHC. So this is the recent note from June. And of course, now they have inverse of a 1-2 inverse femtobarns, but in this one, they have 165 picobarns, inverse picobarns. And you know, if you have a gluon mass of 1,300, then you need your squark mass to be 1,100 or so. However, the production cross-section they're assuming is a little generous, because the efficiency is actually somewhat lower than they're assuming in these curves. So
it says two things which don't quite coincide with
you. Okay.
One of them is what they assume of the cross section, the other is what they assume of the efficiency.
Okay.
Those are two different things.
Right. Okay, so they're additive. So if the production cross section you compute is less than they assume, then that makes it safer. And then also, if your efficiency is lower than what they're quoting to get those curves, then that gives you even more room.
Right.
Okay, that's what I mean.
Okay.
So my model point, the production cross-section is only 16 femtobarns, and the efficiency is still even less than 30%. So if you work out the statistics, if you want a 2 sigma exclusion, then you need 10 inverse femtobarns of data to exclude a model with a 500 GeV gluono.
Well, it's a 500 GeV and 3, not a 500 GeV gluono.
I'm sorry.
So 500 GeV M3.
M3, yes, that's what I mean. Yeah.
And this is assuming exactly the same selections that they did.
Yeah, I duplicate their analysis. Yes. Yeah. All right, and then we can look at multiplicities of certain types of products. So in my software, the tau jet mistag rate is 8% and bjet is 5%. So what you see is that for my model class, the BJET rate is consistent with the mistag rate, whereas a typical point, since the bottom squark is lighter, has a lot more BJETs. And now SPS1A is a bit special, that the tau jet, the stau mass is small enough that it's less than the tau jet cut. So then it's the same as these. So that's not so unique, having few tau jets, but having a few BJETs is interesting. And then I have significantly more multi-lepton events. However, if you check, still the strongest constraint is from jets plus missing ET, not with one or two leptons. Okay, so let's think about the dark matter. So if you have a tan beta of 50, then the cross-section is marginally excluded by xenon 100 at a few times 10 to the minus 46. But if you have a small tan beta, then your cross-section is down here. And so it wouldn't be excluded until xenon 1 ton comes online. And of course, since the chi 1 is mostly beno, the annihilation rate astrophysically is extremely suppressed. It's 10 to the minus 30. Centimeter cubed per second. So you'll never see any signatures from space.
So is xenon 1 ton supposed to have a 2 kV pressure?
Yeah, I think they think they can get their L effective down that low.
Okay. Sorry, because it's a big size detector, right?
Yeah, it's also
just putting in perspective, Ice Cube, when they were designed, their threshold was at, I think, 10 GeV or 25 GeV. Right now, the threshold is at roughly 100 or 200 or 500 GeV. So I don't see one to take
the
numbers.
Let's not hope it's a factor of 10.
Yeah. Actually, with deep core, Ice Cube gets below 100 GeV.
It's still, I think it's still far away from the original, which is about 25 GeV.
They think they can get there, but yeah, it's not happening yet. Yeah.
But the background below 10 to minus 47 centimeters squared gets nasty.
Neutrino
background.
So you're saying it's not just size limited, but limited by neutrino background.
Well, 10 to minus 48 is the same.
I'm told that when they get, David Klein tells me, when they get to 10 to minus 47 centimeters squared, they don't see anything. He's quitting, retiring. Because that's it, as far as he's concerned, background. I don't see correct. I don't straight up.
No, that's right. The but I think it's 10 to minus 48 where the neutrinos from the sun kick in.
Yes, the 10 to minus 47 is your last chance to really have a clean dark matter system.
But it depends a bit. I mean, it's coherently enhanced. It depends on that. It's an n square where n stands out the neutrons because of the weak coupling.
Okay, and finally, we'll just talk a little bit about CP and flavor. So, as far as I know, the like sign muon anomaly is still alive. However, the oscillation is rather constrained. And moreover, your beta S gamma and electronic dipole moments are close to the standard model predictions. So how might you explain this? Well, in this scenario, Yanagida and a few other guys looked at it. You know, if you have a heavy third generation, you can accommodate a large CP angle. So you can explain the dimuon anomaly while still evading these constraints. And that's because, of course, if you have a heavy third generation, that suppresses your beta S gamma. And it also suppresses EDM. And though you do have to assume a hermetic super CKM matrix. And there are predictions for lepton flavor violation, which are within the reach of hypothetical experiments in the future. Now, this claim is getting weaker as the LHC accumulates more data, because right now the best fit for explaining the the Lyxian dimuon anomaly is if your lighter quarks are 900 GeV. So as they get to TeV, 1100 GeV, then your fit becomes not as good. So then, on that note, let me conclude. So, okay, I created an E7 by SO10 model that has some different collider signatures. And as the LHC pushes the color, the mass of the minimum mass of the colored super partners higher, then that weakens the flavor predictions. Okay, so it gets harder and harder to explain the Lyxian dimuon anomaly. However, direct detection is not going anywhere, and because the mass of the dark matter is rather fixed. So if you have large tan beta, maybe it could be excluded with xenon 100. If you have a small tan beta, then you have to wait for xenon 1 ton. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sarah. Do you have more questions? We have plenty during the class, so.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks.
You're probably ruled out by LHC before it's ruled out by
Well, the thing is, you can always make